Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Julian Atkins, one of the founding members of the Society. He's going to talk a little bit about his life so far, why he decided to join the Society, and what the Middle Way means to him. Welcome to the MWS podcast, Julian.
Thanks, Barry. It's good to be here.
Okay, so to start off, Julian, can you give us a bit of background about yourself?
Sure, okay. Well, my interest in the Middle Way Society originated last summer on the retreat that I attended with yourself and Robert and a couple of others. And but my interest in the Middle Way as an idea goes back to an interest in Buddhism, and that in turn comes out of what you might call a religious sensibility that I've had since I was quite young, I think. Yeah.
So, were you influenced by Christianity from an early age, or another religious tradition?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I grew up a nominal Anglican, or in a family that was nominally Anglican. Church was just something we kind of went to on Sundays, didn't play a major role in our lives, although that began to change in my early teens. And I took confirmation classes at the time, and I remember taking that quite seriously. But I was quite disappointed by the outcome. My hopes for that experience weren't realized, really. And
what were those hopes?
Well, I think I hoped that I would have some kind of significant change in my life, in the way that I was making sense of things, intellectually as well as emotionally. And I couldn't really make sense of the Christian doctrine that was being explained to me in more detail at that point. And I kind of put it on the back burner, really. But then in my late teens, I started to pursue a career in classical ballet. So I was training in London at the Royal Ballet School and pouring all my efforts into that. But I, as is often the case, I think in late teens, I was looking for an identity, and I was exploring different ways of expressing myself. Yeah. And I was drawn back to Christianity, partly as a result of the people that I met, but I still had these reservations about the doctrine and such like. Mm-hmm. And I was persuaded to sort of put them on the back burner. In fact, it was a professor of physics who had a very deep Christian faith who really convinced me to do this. He said, look, you know, don't worry about your concerns you got about the doctrine. What you need to do is to embrace a personal relationship with Jesus. So I took this man's advice on face value and really kind of threw myself into Christianity on that basis. And that worked fine for a few years. And it had a big impact on my life. I don't tend to do things by half measures. So when I started to realize that my faith was more in other people than it was in God, and that all my original concerns that I had hadn't really been resolved, things began to unravel quite rapidly. That was quite a crisis for me.
Yeah.
I kind of drifted through my 20s in some senses. I'd left classical ballet by that stage in order to train as an engineer, and that decision was very much wrapped up in what I believed God wanted for my life. So to then lose my faith I hadn't taken up engineering because I'd grown up with a great passion for building things. I wasn't a natural engineer.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of a bit of a fish out of water, to be honest. Although looking back on it, I'm very grateful to have had that experience, because it gave me, a good mathematical and mathematical training and introduction to physics,
yeah.
which I've valued throughout my life since.
Do you have any regrets about giving up the ballet?
I don't regret it in the sense that I kind of lie awake at night wishing that my life had been different. Because obviously that's sort of fruitless exercise. I suppose in terms of looking back, I just trying to take what, you know, appreciate the positive things that various different experiences have, are bringing to my life now. And it's quite surprising how, quite a seemingly disparate range of career pursuits in classical ballet, engineering, and now, nursing, developing on into cognitive behavioral therapy. I've done lots of different things, but it's quite surprising sometimes how they can be complementary. So I don't regret it from that point of view. No.
No. Okay.
I miss it sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. So there you are in your mid-20s, a bit lost at sea. Then what happened?
Well, things started to come together a little bit more for me around about my early 30s, I guess. I managed to sort of start dealing with a few personal issues I had. And in the course of doing that, a friend of mine suggested that I might appreciate a weekend away learning a bit about Buddhist meditation practices.
Uh-huh.
And he was right. I really took to it and I enjoyed it immensely. I settled in Edinburgh around about 2002 and became quite involved in a couple of the Buddhist sanghas here. And it appealed to my religious sensibilities, but didn't require me to commit to any particular beliefs. I think the reason that Buddhism was so attractive for me was by contrast with Christianity, it doesn't particularly matter what you believe. So at the heart of the Christian faith, your salvation is dependent upon what you believe. If you don't believe the wrong things.
Yeah, but in Buddhism, you know, there are some metaphysical claims such as enlightenment, rebirth, karma, etc. So you're saying they were a lot less of an issue for you because of what you just said.
Absolutely, yeah. So the metaphysical claims are all there in Buddhism, but there's not the same social pressure to subscribe to them.
Okay, yeah.
So I felt that I could kind of drift in and out of these Buddhist communities, enjoy the fellowship that I found there, enjoy the practices that we engaged in, enjoy the discussion around kind of, you know, ethics and such like. Without feeling that I had to kind of agree with the more orthodox members of the community. Having said that, I never felt that I could become a card-carrying Buddhist. I never felt that I could actually become a formal member of these groups and participate in decision-making about how the Sangha was run and all that kind of stuff, precisely because I couldn't subscribe to these beliefs.
Okay. Yeah. And then what happened in your Buddhist trajectory?
I got involved quite a lot with reading the thinkers who have been dubbed the new atheists, like, you know, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett. And that was actually, I think from a psychological point of view, that was actually quite important for me. It's almost like a lot of anger was kind of crystallizing around what had happened to me during my 20s and essentially a kind of betrayal. And what was difficult about that was there was nobody to blame you know, what, nobody did anything bad to me in the sense that they willfully deceived me. All the people that I met in the Christian church were, as far as I was aware, very genuine and sincere people. And the stuff they were telling me and the advice they were giving me, was all well meant. So I didn't, but I still felt this kind of anger at having been betrayed. So I think reading people like Daniel Dennett helped me to kind of process that, particularly Daniel Dennett, actually, who sees religion as a kind of natural phenomenon. And once you understand it in that sort of slightly less personal way, it's just something which human beings do. I'm prone to these kind of metaphysical beliefs and certain ways of telling stories about the world. And there's not anything, you know, deliberately malicious about that. It's not been engineered to be that way. It's evolved to be that way.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt that actually helped me sort of.
So what happened to this sense of betrayal there?
Well, just understanding it, you know, in terms of what happened and like I said, understanding religion as a natural phenomenon. It's not, I don't know what happened to the betrayal. I think just as I began to reframe what had happened to me a little bit better, it just kind of disappeared, really. It just kind of went.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you became interested in secular Buddhism. Did that have anything to do with reading Stephen Batchelor at all?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as you know, Stephen is a very important influence in my life. In fact, I think if it wasn't for Stephen and Martine, I probably wouldn't have been able to remain engaged with Buddhism in quite the way I have over the last 10 years. Indeed, I sort of ended up hanging out with a bunch of friends, just kind of meeting, meditating in each other's front rooms for several years, and talking about approaches to the Dharma informed by people like Stephen Batchelor and John Peacock and such like. And then around about 2010, I think it was, I was actually giving a talk to our local humanist society about Buddhist ideas, secular Buddhist ideas. And I was challenged, you know, well, would you be interested in setting up a meditation group for humanists? And I'd always resisted putting myself in a position where I might be seen as a teacher. On the understanding that I would be facilitating a peer group, I agreed to do this. And what's emerged out of that is a group that eventually became known as Secular Sangha, Edinburgh Secular Sangha. So that's what I've been kind of involved in practice-wise over the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so bringing the talk up to the present, well, you mentioned that you went on the retreat in August, the Middle Way philosophy retreat. Can you describe that experience and why you decided to join the society?
Yeah, it was. I mean, for me, I think the biggest thing that stands out for me about that retreat was having the idea of the fact value distinction challenged. So that's this idea in Western philosophy and Western thought in general, really, that facts and values are somehow in separate domains.
Yeah.
And it's something I've been thinking about for a while, because I've always taken that on face value and just accepted that. It made sense to me, you know. You can sort of investigate the way the world is, but that doesn't tell you how you ought to behave within it, for example.
Okay.
So a good example might be, you can have a good evolutionary explanation of why human beings are prone to xenophobia.
Yeah.
because we have evolved as tribal creatures, and you see outgroup hostility being displayed in chimpanzees, for example, who are our close relatives, genetically speaking. So it's understandable that we've evolved similar kinds of behaviors ourselves.
Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't tell you that it's right. It doesn't give you any information about what your values should be around that. So that's a classic example of how you might, like a classic instance of where the fact value distinction seems intuitive.
Okay.
So yeah, that, I mean, in terms of my thinking, the idea that the dividing line between these isn't really there is, was quite a change in the way that I think about the world. I mean, it is tied in. I mean, it's something I've been thinking about for longer than that goes back before last summer. I mean, Sam Harris, of course, is one of the new atheists that's written this book, The Moral Landscape, where he treats morality as being a kind of scientific question almost. Mm-hmm. And I've got some reservations about Sam's approach, but I have always, or for a long time, I've felt that you can't separate the two out in quite the way that Western philosophy has done. Certainly our understanding of our values has to be informed by the way things are, or the way that we can best, our best guess at the way things are anyway.
Okay. Do you still consider yourself an atheist? You just mentioned Sam Harris. I know that you went through a period of considering yourself one. How do you stand now?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I've always made a distinction, I suppose. I've often said I'm a kind of philosophically speaking, I'm an agnostic, but a de facto atheist. And what I mean by that is that I don't believe that you can know that there isn't a God any more than you can know there is a God. But I'm an atheist in the sense that I'm not a theist in the sense that I don't pay any attention to ideas about God. It doesn't affect the way that I live my life. I don't take God into account when I get up in the morning. So that's what I mean by being an atheist. I don't mean, you know, I'm not going to stand on a soapbox and say I know that God doesn't exist, because of course I recognize that nobody can know that. So in that sense, I'm a kind of a militant agnostic. I say, yeah, I don't know that God exists, but neither do you, you know.
Okay. And what does the middle way mean to you?
Well, of course, I mean, I first came across the idea of the middle way in Buddhism, and I think probably in common with a lot of people, my initial impression of this idea was simply that it's some kind of notion of temperance, you know, that you don't go to the extremes of asceticism on the one hand, but going to the extremes of self-indulgence and a certain kind of hedonism at the other end of the spectrum is equally unhelpful. So, but obviously I've come to understand it in a much wider way, a much deeper way, as time has gone on, as being a middle way between well, I suppose in the classical framework, a middle way between certain eternalistic metaphysical perspectives and nihilistic metaphysical perspectives. But I mean, any kind of metaphysical opposites could stand in for those too. So just basically trying to sort of put these questions about what happens after we die and what's the ultimate nature of reality and such like on one side, and engage with experience as we find it in a more kind of pragmatic way. So I think it's got much in common with various sort of pragmatic philosophical traditions.
Okay, and And what about this notion of integration as part of middle way philosophy? What are your thoughts on that?
I find it a very helpful idea. Rather than demonizing certain desires that we have, recognizing that desires are just desires, and you know, we have them, and desires are complex. My understanding of desire is that it's got different components. It's got cognitive as well as affective components. How we feel about things is very intimately linked with how we think about things and what we believe. And I guess this fits very much with my experience as a cognitive behavioral therapist as well. Bringing these ideas together in a way that they're working together. So how can we meet our human needs in the most holistic way, so that we're not trying to suppress anything, basically. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier in the talk that you you run a meditation group in Edinburgh called the Secular Sangha. And since the retreat, you've decided to introduce elements of middle way philosophy to your group. How are you getting on with that?
It's been interesting so far, actually. One of our members is a logician. So he is a professional academic, and trying to introduce a notion like the middle way to somebody with such extensive learning in logic was quite challenging. So I'm not sure that Joe is buying this, but there's other members of the group that are kind of more open to it, and it always provokes interesting conversation. I think the balance is really meeting the needs of people who maybe like myself and Joe, who are quite kind of philosophically inclined, if you like. We like to get our teeth stuck into sort of talking about these ideas.
Sorry, what are Joe's main objections?
Well, obviously, I don't want to speak for Joe.
Of course, yeah.
But
what do you think they are?
I think my suspicion is, or my, you know, the impression that I get is that Joe is quite skeptical that you can do away with metaphysical foundations altogether.
Okay.
So this and this idea that you can have a way of going on in life that is objective, that is kind of anti-foundational, or in Robert's terminology, has a negative foundationalism, is quite alien to Western analytic philosophy, I think, and obviously Joe is much more familiar with those ideas.
Okay.
For example, you know, one of his objections might be something along the lines of, you have to have certain metaphysical beliefs about the existence of time and space in order to go about living your life. So the thought experiment might be that the universe came into existence last Thursday, okay, complete with all your memories of what existed prior to last Thursday. So what existed prior to last Thursday, just memories that were created last Thursday. And there's no way of proving that one way or the other.
My brain just went all wobbly then.
Sorry?
My brain just went all wobbly.
So this is like a kind of a classic thought experiment. It's in the same kind of genre as the kind of brain in the vat type thought experiments.
Okay, yeah.
Sort of things that are explored in movies like The Matrix, you know. So Joe, I think Joe's stance would be that, you know, you have to believe in time. And my understanding of Robert's approach is more that, well, all you have to do is not to make any definite commitment to whether or not the world came into existence last Thursday, but just to say, well, this is the way it seems to me, and these are my beliefs. I go about my life assuming that these memories I have of my childhood, for example, are meaningful, and I incorporate them into the decisions I'm making now, and I carry on with the assumption that the world's going to continue beyond next Thursday.
Yeah.
I don't have to make any ultimate claims about that. I can hold those beliefs provisionally, and what matters is whether or not my beliefs are coherent and whether they're working for me at a pragmatic level.
Yeah.
So, it's but to come back to your kind of question before that, I suppose, it's balancing having the conversations that I've just been touching on just now with remaining grounded in, you know, meditation practice and talking about day-to-day interests. Some people are quite interested in philosophy, some people aren't. So it's, you know, with a group like Secular Sangha, it's a case of striking the right balance.
Yeah. Anyway, Julian, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, and thank you for giving up some of your time to tell us a bit about your life and your views about Buddhism and the Middle Way, and good luck with your meditation group in Edinburgh.
Thank you, Barry. Thanks a lot for asking me. It's been fun to chat.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.